versus Beardsley.
Pile of papers of it. Do you want to get them?
Okay. Is it Mr. Tamayo?
Tamayo is the way I say it. Tamayo, yes.
All right, Mr.
In Italy, we have to say it the way you said it.
All right. That must have been what I was thinking. So, Mr.
Tamayo, Tamayo.
Mr. Tamayo.
Tamayo in the United States.
So you have reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal. So you're anticipating a big finish. That gives you 6 minutes out of the gate. So the floor is yours, Mr. Tamayo.
Well, and the reason I did, well, may it please the court, my name is Peter Tamayo, and I represent Mr. Beardsley. The reason I reserved that time is that essentially it's a pretty straightforward argument I have to make. There was a specific rule of a federal criminal procedure which required the sentencing judge to ascertain and make sure that the defendant had read the pre-sentence report. When the judge asked the question to my client, did you read the pre-sentence report? My client said no.
Well, I mean, he'd had it for weeks. He just hadn't bothered to read it. And then he said he didn't want to wait any longer and he was content to go forward. But even before we get there, though, Mr. Tamayo, because this is the point raised in the government's brief and addressed in your reply, there's an appeal waiver here. And so why is it that the appeal waiver is not enforceable? It seems to me you're suggesting that a violation of Rule 32, and specifically the duty of the district judge to verify that the defendant and his attorney have reviewed the PSR, why that gets you out of an appeal waiver.
Because
I've never said that, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
We've never said that a violation of that provision of Rule 32 vitiates an appeal waiver.
No, because I don't believe that issue has come up really anywhere in terms of the waiver issue. However, generally, the court does not enforce the waiver for an error that the defendant could not have anticipated. I think the defendant had every right to expect that the judge...
Error that the defendant could not have anticipated at sentencing gets him out of the appeal waiver in a plea agreement?
Yes, Your Honor, I would. That he
knowingly and voluntarily entered?
Yes, because he could not have anticipated that the judge would not follow the rules of criminal procedure. He was entitled to anticipate that the judge would follow those rules.
Well, there's a rule of criminal procedure that requires judges to resolve objections to the PSR or say that they aren't required to, or that aren't necessary for purposes of sentencing. So you would say the appeal waiver wouldn't apply to that as well?
I think it's a little different situation, Your Honor, because one of the things in the plea agreement, in the appeal waiver, is he agrees to not appeal a sentence for falls within the range, despite the way it was determined. So the argument could be made that the ruling on an objection to the something in the PSR would be in the way it was determined. Here, it's really much more basic. It really goes to the organic aspect of sentencing. Does this individual who's being sentenced know what he's being, the basis on which he's being sentenced? That's in the PSR. That's what he was entitled to have the judge verify. And when the judge couldn't verify that, the judge should not have proceeded with sentencing at that point in time.
So if the judge asks, have you reviewed the PSR and discussed it with your attorney, or have you reviewed the PSR in this case, and the defendant says no, and I'm not going to, what should the judge do? And in that circumstances, would an appeal waiver preclude an appeal based on violation of the rule?
Well, it's a little different situation than we had, and I've thought about that and trying to think about what would happen. I mean, I imagine the judge could consider to hold
them. Start with the appeal waiver question. If that happened, would you make the same argument about appeal waiver?
Well, the rule that applies to how you determine the objections to the pre-sentence report is different than the rule we're talking about. It's a different provision of Rule 32.
But in any event,
to answer your question, not to fall into the trap that, you know, sometimes of trying to overthink the question, I would say respectfully, that's not the same situation. I think in this case, the judge, to get to your earlier question, what could the judge have done? The judge could have done a couple of things. Number one, he could have said, as he had suggested, had been suggested in an earlier proceeding, you know, go down back to the holding cell. Here's the report. Read it. And then if he doesn't read it, then he could be considered some sort of contempt procedure, you know, holding him in contempt.
You could read aloud to him, too, if you wanted, but then maybe the defendant would hold his ears. And, I mean, it can't be possible that this is an unwaivable right under Rule 32, can it?
I think he could be waived at if the judge said to him,
you can actually waive the PSR entirely.
Of course. I mean,
so
it happens all the time.
If you waive the PSR entirely, why can't you waive additional time to review it if you express, I don't want to review it? Why can't that be waived?
Well, that's not what he said. He didn't say, I don't want to review it. He said he didn't want an adjournment.
He said, I don't want to stop. The government, the court never said he wouldn't give him an adjournment. The court noted that he seemed to be dragging his feet. He asked the government's position. The government wanted to go forward. And then your client interjected and said, Your Honor, I'm going. We're going to continue with sentencing regardless of today. And I don't want no more postponements.
Well, Your Honor, the way I read that, and I was that he was basically acquiescing to what he understood the judge's ruling was. The judge was going to go forward. The judge was saying.
The judge made no ruling. The judge didn't say, I'm not adjourning the sentencing. I'm not going to give you more time. The judge noted, it appears that you're dragging your feet because of the history, which was pretty obvious.
Well, is it, though? I mean, if you go back over the history.
They had to use a force order to get him to court.
Well, that was one day. So, I mean, he's not dragging his feet over a long period of time. I mean, he's got.
And then he refused to get out of his cell for the originally scheduled sentencing, and then it required a force order to get him.
Right. Well, that was just one day. I mean, it's not dragging his feet over a long period of time.
I mean, we have frequent precedents where we say not coming to court is deemed to be a waiver of your right to appear for various things. I mean, it would seem to me that this record cries out that this is a waiver of the right to review the PSR. How is that not a waiver? He had the PSR.
He had
the PSR
for
weeks.
The old rule, before the amendment, said the judge had to ascertain that he had an opportunity to review it. If he had been under the old rule, there would not be an issue here. But the rule was amended specifically to create an affirmative obligation on the sentencing judge to determine that he had in fact read it. Now,
and so if a defendant refuses to read it, the system is stymied. That's the same as, and I guess if he refuses to get out of his cell, then maybe the court can't do anything about that either. I mean, it can't be the case that a defendant who adamantly refuses to read a PSR can't be sentenced. You're not suggesting that.
No, I'm not, Your Honor. But I'm saying that's not the situation we had here. He did not adamantly refuse to read it.
He said he wanted no more adjournments.
Well, at that point in time, the record to me is that the judge had already determined he was going forward, and he had acquiesced in that. And when the judge asked him, does he have any objections, he says, I don't even know what it is that I could be objecting to. At the very end of the proceeding, when the judge asked him, is there anything else we can do, he says, I don't even understand what was going on here with the report. Your Honor, respectfully, I did reserve time.
Yeah.
And I believe, however, that, you know, on the basis of my arguments, this ought to be reversed.
All right, thank you. We'll now hear from Mr. Crewley. Am I pronouncing that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Crewley, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, Charles Crewley for the United States. Before I get to the appeal waiver, I want to respond to my friend's suggestion that the district court should have just granted a brief adjournment, even for a matter of hours. And I don't think that's the correct question here. The question isn't, what should the district court have done? The question is, what would that have accomplished? On this record, on these facts, I think there was a more than sufficient basis for the district court to conclude that any adjournment would have been a futile effort. When the PSR was initially drafted, the appellant twice refused to meet with the probation officer, at one point telling the probation officer, and this is at paragraph 103 of the PSR, telling the probation officer that he had to go to the recreation yard. When the PSR was first drafted in 2024, the appellant refused to meet with his attorneys to review the PSR. He fired them and moved to withdraw. When sentencing was initially scheduled on January 14th of 2025, the appellant was brought to court the day before, and the district court understood and realized that the appellant wasn't prepared for sentencing, and to accommodate that, the district court granted a 45-day adjournment. Those 45 days came and went, and nothing happened. The appellant, as the court noted, appellant had to be forced to court on the 27th, and at that point, the district court learned that the appellant had done nothing with the preceding 45 days. He had done nothing with the PSR that was in his possession. So I think the district court had a more than adequate record to conclude that an adjournment of any length would have been futile. The government concedes and acknowledges that this is obviously not the way this process should play out, but I think the district court did the best it could with a difficult defendant who was really doing everything in his power to stonewall.
But so that requires us, though, to decide whether there's been a Rule 32I1A violation, whether the rule was violated. You're saying it wasn't, or it was waived. I get that. But I guess another question is whether or not a violation, an actual violation of 32I1A, is even enough to vitiate a plea agreement with an appeal waiver. And so I think maybe we should spend a little bit of time on that. If the judge had just forgotten, just didn't ask, and proceeded with sentencing, and the record makes it very clear there was no verification about whether the defendant had received and reviewed the PSR, would you nonetheless still be arguing that you're out of luck, you've got an appeal waiver, and the Rule 32 violation is not the same as a Rule 11 or lack of voluntary and intelligent waiver?
I think it would depend, Your Honor, on whether there were facts like in Gates suggesting that regardless of whether the district court asked the appellant whether he'd reviewed the PSR, whether the appellant had in fact reviewed the PSR. So, for example, in Gates...
Well, I'm asking you a hypothetical where it's clear that there hasn't been a verification and the record is not clear whether the defendant actually read it. Is that enough to vitiate an appeal waiver?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. This appeal waiver required the defendant, the appellant, to waive his right to appeal any sentence less than life, notwithstanding the manner in which the district court determined the sentence.
What if no PSR was done at all and there was no waiver of that? So the PSR wasn't prepared, the judges went forward with the sentencing.
Then I think at that point we would have an argument that the
waiver doesn't apply.
That's correct, Your Honor, because
what's the difference if he doesn't verify? He or she doesn't verify that it was read, essentially the same as not having gotten it, right? Because the defendant may have not have gotten it, may have not have read it. So if there was nothing mentioned about the PSR and the judges went forward with sentencing, there was no verification, it seems to me pretty problematic, right?
I agree, Your Honor. And I think, though, it really depends on whether there's evidence in the record.
There's another issue about the waiver that Mr. Tomeo raised in his reply brief. I don't know if he raised it in the initial brief. The judge said something curious when there was this back and forth. The judge said, so all these issues, Mr. Beardsley, that you believe you haven't been adequately addressed, you can present those arguments to the appellate court. And that was somehow giving him solace, like you can go forward today because you're gonna be able to raise all these things with the appellate court. And he noted that the Supreme Court's, I think it's the Hunter case, heard argument about whether or not a judge by, I don't know what the circumstance, I didn't read the Hunter case, that could somehow function to undo the waiver. Is that a problem or not?
No, Your Honor, for two reasons. First, I think in context, the district court's comments that Your Honor was referring to was directed to the appellant's concerns he had raised about his prior counsel. It would, I don't think in context, was understood as a general invitation to appeal any issue that might arise.
He did talk about the prior counsel and that they didn't do anything for him, but he was talking about suppression. It seemed like, I don't know if there was a suppression motion he wanted to be made, or I don't know what, he didn't just limit his comments to he had issues with his lawyers, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, but at the end of the sentencing colloquy, the district court did confirm for the appellant that he had waived his right to appeal, and it advised the appellant that those waivers are generally enforceable and that if he wished to challenge the waiver, he had to do so before this court. So I think, read as a whole, the transcript makes clear that the district court conveyed to the appellant that he had waived his right to appeal. And I think the court's comment that Your Honor was referring to needs to be understood in the context of that entire transcript. Regardless, though, of whether the appeal waiver is enforceable.
Well, just on that, to the extent, you're about to make an argument, it doesn't matter because we could conclude on the merits that it's either plain error or harmless error. But just to the structure of the analysis on the appeal waiver question, I think, is kind of the distinction between the Aravella case and the, I'm sure I'm saying this wrong, Le Jeunesse case. And, right, Le Jeunesse kind of asks whether there's this historical fundamental right in issue, in which case it's not waivable. You answered Judge Bianco that would be true, I think, for a failure to prepare a pre-sentence report. Would we need to, is that because there's some, I mean, it'd be weird to say there's some sort of historical fundamental right to a to get the pre-sentence report,
all the way back to 1987.
Yeah,
I don't think it's that fine of a point. I think that kind of the right that animates that would be the right to have the district court consider accurate facts at sentencing, and the pre-sentence report is a vehicle.
Right. So why isn't that the right level of generality for the right in issue here, which is whether the defendant has read the facts that will be the sentencing record?
Because Rule 32I is a two-way street. It requires the district court to advise the appellant or the defendant of his right, of his need to review the PSR, but it also obligates the defendant to do something to read the PSR.
But I understood your answer to Judge Sullivan, maybe I'm wrong, would be even if it's a clear violation of this rule, the judge just didn't do it, that would be encompassed within the appeal waiver.
Yes, Your Honor, but I think, again, to Your Honor's question about the level of generality, I think we need to be practical about the nature of the rule when we're looking at what the rule is and whether that rule survives an appeal waiver. This court has described rules that survive appeal waivers as rules that would irreparably discredit the federal courts, like in Lugenay's, the right to elocution, or sentences that are imbued with racism.
Well, I mean, we've generally articulated only five bases to get out from under an appeal waiver. La Jeunesse is now, I guess, arguably a sixth, but it opens this Rule 32 door, and the question is, what do we do with other Rule 32? Rule 32 is a long rule. There's a lot of subsections, and so are they all entitled to the La Jeunesse?
No.
No, I don't think you're arguing that, but so is this one that just doesn't? It's just, you're out of luck. He didn't read the PSR. There's a lot of stuff in there he didn't know, but he knew he was going to get 25, and that's exactly what he got.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So why are we here? Why do we need to bother then? And on your view, this is not a problem. Assume the worst, and it doesn't matter. Rule 32I1A is not La Jeunesse, and it doesn't open the door to not enforcing an appeal waiver.
Where the appellant has had the opportunity to review the PSR and chooses not to, I think that's correct. And that's obviously what happened here.
Isn't that different than an appeal waiver argument? You're saying factually he sort of waived his right under the rule. Correct me if I'm wrong, that's the kind of analysis you engage in if you're considering the merits of the error.
Yes, Your Honor, and I acknowledge it's a little confusing, but I think when this court has looked at the nature of the rights that survive appeal waivers, and I'm thinking of the Riggi, I believe I'm pronouncing it correctly, case, the court has not always looked at the nature of the right in strict technical terms. It's sometimes taken a more practical view of what was before the district court when it was trying to enforce this right. So in Riggi, the question was whether an ex post facto violation involving different guidelines manuals survived an appeal waiver. And what this court said was the district court understood there was an issue, recognized the issue, and ultimately concluded that it wouldn't matter. And the analogy isn't perfect, but I think we have to take a similarly practical view of the right at issue in this case, where the district court tried to comply with the rule, but was met with a defendant who wanted no part of that, and ultimately has not objected to any of the facts in the PSR, pointed to any facts that are incorrect, got exactly what he bargained for in the plea agreement, and otherwise has not shown how he was prejudiced by his own failure to review the PSR, which brings me to my last point, which is that regardless of the appeal waiver, the court should affirm because the sentence here was reasonable, and the appellant hasn't shown that the district court plainly erred in failing to fully comply with Rule 32I. So unless the court has questions, we'd ask the court to dismiss based on the appeal waiver or in the alternative, affirm. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll now have Mr. Tomeo for 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. So there's a couple of points I wanted to address. One is there's a suggestion that my colleague has made that this is a series of delays caused by the defendant in this. However, you look at the...
One could infer that, it seems to me, from the facts?
Well, I think if you look behind the facts, or if you look to the facts in a little more detail, you see it wasn't. The original sentencing date on this was January 13th, or 14th. On the January 13th, the government filed its sentencing memorandum, but didn't allow the defendant to have a copy. He shows up to court on the 14th, and they're not ready to go because he hasn't had an opportunity to even see the government's objections. And the judge then grants an extension of time. That's where that concept came up. His counsel at the time had said, why don't we just take a recess? We can go downstairs. He can look over the objection. But ultimately it was decided that there would be an adjournment. Now, what happened after that adjournment? What happened after that adjournment is that Mr. Beardsley did meet with the probation officer. He went through an interview, which he had been resisting before that, but he agreed to do that after the 13th, and it resulted in more than 12 paragraphs of the PSR being amended. He did not get that. That's the report he got 2 weeks before the sentencing date. So there was progress being made. This wasn't him trying to stop this going forward. He did have, I think, an argument for why he hadn't read it. He said he was, at the time, having a problem with his foot. And he said that that was then resolved when he showed up in court on the 28th. So there was every reason for the judge to believe that if he gave him additional time.
What about the force order? Why was that necessary?
Well, I don't know. It's not really in the record. It's certainly, if that was a series of force orders, but that delay would only have been one day.
First one's free.
Well, it's only one day. I mean, it's not a history of trying to slow this down.
That background you just gave also shows that the defendant would know if he genuinely needs more time, that the court would be open to giving him more time. And not only does he not ask for more time, he says he wants to proceed.
Well, as I said, Your Honor, the way I read that is not that he's acquiescing in the judge already indicating he was going to go forward with sentencing and he was not going to grant any additional time.
Are there any errors that you've identified in the PSR? Any objections that would be made with time?
The one that is in the record is his concern about his learning disability not being covered. And if you look at the PSR does not make any findings regarding the learning disability.
It references.
It indicates that he did raise that, but doesn't go in any further detailing in terms of that. It suggests that the only basis that the probation officer was aware of was regarding a finding that he had. I always get these letters wrong. ADHD, yes.
But he was representing himself, so he was free to make these arguments to the court if he wanted to, right? Learning disabilities, I had, et cetera. He didn't know he had a learning disability?
He did know he had a learning disability. He didn't feel that that had been adequately addressed in the PSR.
The question I'm addressing, Your Honor,
is yes, he did bring that to the court's attention when he spoke. But it wasn't in terms of context of the PSR. The PSR was also not simply a sentencing document. Your Honor. PSL has life that continues after sentencing. It becomes, in the Bureau of Prisons, it's referred to as the Bible. Things that are in the pre-sentence report are considered to be determined fact and are not subject to review in
but
administrative
so he
proceedings
would have
down
asked
the road.
For the district court to do what?
To make amendments to the PSR. I've done that when I've been in the district court.
What amendment?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What amendment?
Well, he may have asked to have more discussion regarding the learning disability, that there was, and to have specific findings made in the PSR regarding his learning disability.
So a finding,
but that's the only one.
He would ask for a finding that he has ADHD, and the district court would take additional evidence as to that, or it would just reflect that he represents that he has ADHD. Just as a practical matter, what would the report do?
The report, well, it depends on what they agree to. What normally would be done is an objection would have been made to that paragraph to say that it should have included additional information regarding his learning disability, which was not there.
What information?
Well, Your Honor, I didn't represent him below. He represented himself. What he put on, all we know is that he put on the record that he would have put additional information
and I'm
in.
Asking,
now, if we could,
I'm asking from a harmlessness perspective, if even now you can identify anything more that would have been done had he read the PSR.
Well, one way that this could be resolved is this could be remanded to the court for further proceedings in which the court could ask that a application be made as what additional information he would bring before the court and then rule on whether that would have been appropriate for sentencing or not. It could have decided that record. A lot of times when we raise those kind of issues, I'm sure Your Honor has seen this, in a sentencing proceeding, the government will concede that and will say, okay, we'll agree to that amendment. And those types of amendments are routinely made in PSRs, in my experience. And they do sometimes have important important ramifications for the defendant's incarceration, which in this case is going to be for decades.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We will reserve decision.
Thank you.